Frankly, I'm not too wild about this next event, but it has become a tradition here at Adams. The belching contest.
This is Mike Harmon.
And April Harmon.
You're listening to another Surely You Can't Be Serious podcast with my buddy Jason Colvin and Dee Graves.
Jason, what is the worst episode of the Surely You Can't Be Serious podcast?
Well, that would be hard to say, sir. They're each outstanding in their way.
Cut the horse shit, son. I've got the analytical files right here. We had an episode that dropped a whole truckload of fizzies in the varsity swim meet. An episode that medical school cadavers went to the alumni dinner. Every dadgum Halloween, this thing pops up and the trees are filled with underwear, and every spring the toilets explode.
You're talking about the best Super Bowl commercials of 2021, sir.
Of course I'm talking about the best Super Bowl commercials of 2021, you twerp. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Surely You Can't Be Serious podcast, where even we get one wrong from time to time.
Hey, you know, you can't hit home runs all the time.
We are back with a second part to our comparison of National Lampoon Animal House versus Revenge of the Nerds.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. I enjoy both of these movies. They're funny. They're classics.
I love it that our guys, our Shirley fans, who we communicate with on Patreon and texting and all sorts of things, as soon as this episode were over, like, hey, you guys missed this and you forgot about that. And there were some things that you... And guys, it's a two-part episode. We got to leave some gas in the tank to get home, okay?
Right.
Good gracious. Right. So two Patreon members, Def Dave, David Wright, and Chris Weber, both pointed out that Bruce McGill, the D-Day from Animal House, was the sheriff in My Cousin Vinny.
Great movie. We haven't covered that one yet.
I shot the clerk. Yeah. Is what he said.
That's it.
Yeah.
Bruce McGill.
Yes. Thank you, guys. We didn't know that. And then Def Dave also pointed out that Bernie Casey, in addition to being in Spies Like Us and Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, was in I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker. And Def Dave pointed out that Dean Vernon Wormer, also in I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker. I haven't seen that movie, so I did not know that.
Wow. You haven't seen I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker?
You've seen it?
Sure. How much for one rib? That's from that movie, so yeah.
Okay, all right, yeah. Nice.
Chris Rock, early Chris Rock, yes.
Yeah. Okay, if I may nerd out here for just a second.
Please.
There is an elementary particle that is a quantum of the electromagnetic field, including electromagnetic radiation such as light and radio waves, and is the force carrier for the electromagnetic force. And the idea of this particle was postulated by Max Planck, who then that theory was expounded upon by Albert Einstein, and then ultimately this particle was given a name, and the name was a photon. And the guy who gave it that name was a physicist named Gilbert Lewis, which is where we get the names for our two nerds in Revenge of the Nerds.
Are you kidding me?
There you go.
That is a great story, man. I liked your nerd voice too.
Thank you. Okay, and last week, you know, throwing some credit to another Patreon member, James Buckley, counselor.
The Bayou barrister?
Yeah, exactly.
The Cajun counselor?
When we discussed the plethora of crimes which are committed within Revenge of the Nerds, not mentioning any from Animal House, which is also copious, but... So there's a rather infamous scene in Revenge of the Nerds,
yeah,
where our hero...
Hero
of the movie, if you will, dons the mask of the villain of the movie in order to gain carnal knowledge of the villain's girlfriend, who has been a total B to him the whole time.
Right.
But...
Betty Childs.
And they go to the fun house, and he says he wants to leave the mask on. And it's kind of, they try to tame it a little bit by it being like this wonderful experience for her, and it causes her change over and all of this other stuff.
Right.
But what we have is a case of rape by deception.
Yeah, so I emailed James. I think you and I both contacted him separately,
mm-hmm,
independent of each other. And I said, what is the legality of that, right? Because he didn't force her, but he deceived her.
Right.
And so what is, you know, what is he really guilty of? He sent me this case and it blew my doors off.
Right. Yeah. The case is called Boro versus Superior Court. Here's the facts of this case. Okay.
Yeah.
There was Daniel Boro, who was the defendant, who was charged with rape, but the circumstances were that his quote unquote victim had been fooled by him. He called her and posed as a doctor, told her that she had a significant disease, and he called himself Dr. Stevens. So that's a little bit iffy, but she didn't know any other Dr. Stevens. So that's an important factor in this. Okay. And so as Dr. Stevens, he says, you have this rare condition and the only way to cure it is a rather long and expensive and painful surgery.
Yeah.
Or you can have sex with someone who has the antibodies for this disease.
Yes.
And that will cure you as well. And as it turns out, I am somebody who has the antibodies for this disease.
It just so happens.
Just coincidence.
I mean, plus, look at this. Plus, he coerced her to pay him $1,000 for the pleasure of banging her brains out.
So this victim agrees to meet with him at a hotel room. They do the deed, and then later on, I'm sure she's...
Wait, he vaccinates her.
He injects her? He inoculates her?
Yes.
They do the deed, and then I guess later on, she's telling somebody about this, and they're like, you got to be kidding me. Did you really fall for this? And so they try to pursue charges against this guy, but what the court said is that fraud in the inducement of sexual intercourse does not vitiate consent. And what that means is, just because I lied to you to get you in bed doesn't mean that your consent to sex is not real consent. And so it's not rape.
That is so shocking to me.
It is a bit weird, but if you think how many girls that you probably fudged the truth on a little bit as you were trying to learn how to unclasp their bra strap, then you would see how any way that this becomes a crime puts people in a lot of danger of going to jail. Specifically, I'm thinking of the scene in Animal House when he goes posing as...
Von Liebowitz.
Yes, when he goes posing as Von Liebowitz's fiancé. Well, they were engaged to be engaged.
Engaged to be engaged, you know?
Because he absolutely lies to get her roommate into bed, and it works, but it's the same thing. Just because you're lying to get sex doesn't make it rape.
All right. Let's talk about some other scenes from the movie.
Okay.
You know, we talked about Doug Kinney. Doug Kinney is the guy who started National Lampoon magazine, or it was Harvard Lampoon, then it became National Lampoon. He has a couple of lines in Animal House.
Yeah, he's one of the frat guys, just the kind of in the background, very nerdy looking frat guy at that.
His haircut is so weird in this movie.
Yeah, he's got the big glasses, but everybody, I mean, his line is one of the most famous lines for the movie.
What the hell are we supposed to do, you moron?
Yeah.
That's Doug Kinney.
God rest his soul.
Yeah. And then, you know, we've talked before, he fell tragically to his death. Now, whether or not that was suicide or not.
But it was Harold Ramis, I believe, that said, Doug fell while looking for a place to jump off.
Yeah, that's right. He also takes over the band at the end of the movie. You know, they have that marching band when all the chaos is about to break out. And the guy tosses his baton in the air. And mid-toss, Doug Kinney shoves him out of the way, catches the baton, and leads the band.
Nice.
So there you go. Let's talk about the Von Liebowitz scene.
Okay.
It's super funny. But again, it kind of relates to when Lewis impersonates Stan. So you have Otter that goes to the Emily Dickinson College, the all-girls school.
Right.
And they know that this girl has passed away.
Yeah, they're looking at the newspaper article as they're driving to the Emily Dickinson
What's this
college.
Girl's name again? Von Liebowitz.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'll be right back. And so he goes inside and he says, hi, I'm here to pick up Von Liebowitz. I'm her fiancé. And of course, everybody's like, what? And so they call down her roommate. And I don't know this girl's name, but boy, she is stunning.
Mm-hmm.
And she comes down and she's like, I am so sorry to tell you this, but Fawn passed away tragically. And she hands him a newspaper and it's like, sophomore killed in kiln explosion. And he's like, she was making me a pot. And she's trying to comfort him. Of course, Otter is working her the whole way. And he's like, I just don't think I should be alone this evening. And so she agrees to go out with him, and he says, oh, by the way, grab 3 dates for my friends.
Yeah.
And that's when they go to the Otis Day concert.
Right.
Where they're the only white people in the entire place, and there's a record scratch and that whole thing. So then Otter takes, the girl's name is Shelley, takes her to the car, starts working her over in the back seat, and he's like, I used to touch Fawn this way. She's like, I know, she told me. He kind of looks at her.
Oh, my gosh.
She did?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, she was raring to go just like he was. Yes, she was.
And then, of course, everybody gets kicked out of the club, and then she's half naked when they all jump in the car, and they're crashing the car around the parking lot. Funny, funny scene.
Great scene.
That scene, Chris Miller said, absolute truth, actually happened in real life.
Oh, my gosh. All of it?
That's what he said.
Wow. Can we dance with your women?
Do you mind if we dance with your dates?
Do you mind if we dance with your dates?
Why, no, not at all.
My Chris Bauer, Patreon member Chris Bauer, a.k.a. Bomber, my buddy in high school, he would come up out of nowhere while you're in math class or whatever, and he'd come up behind you, and he'd be like, do you mind if we dance with your dates? Okay. I want to talk about a certain scene when they're all visiting Dean Wormer's office. He's going through the grade point averages. You know, you're like a 0.1 and you're a 0.2. You know, you're the best one at a 1.2. And basically he's telling them they're kicked out. And he's looking at Flounder, and Flounder's getting more and more upset. And you can tell he's
fat, trying. Drunk and stupid is no way to go through life, son.
And so he's trying to say something, and Wormer's like, out with it. What is it? You know, speak. And it's obviously he barfs all over the place. They had to cut that because that was too much for the viewing audiences of 1978. They actually pointed out that just a few years later in Stand By Me, there's a giant vomiting scene.
Well, I was just sitting here thinking, hadn't The Exorcist already come out at this point?
I guess so, yeah.
Or was it 79? When did The Exorcist came out?
Exorcist was 73.
Yeah, so 5 years earlier, you get a girl spitting pea soup as her head spins around, but one drunk frat boy vomiting is too much.
They would not show that scene. They wouldn't show the barfing.
Weird.
Okay, I definitely want to talk about the end scene when the Deltas finally get back at everybody by taking over and like terrorizing this town parade.
Right.
They cause all this commotion. All these floats are crashing, and there's a little boy in his bedroom looking at a Playboy. Mm-hmm. And when they crash, like, it launches a half-naked woman into his room, and he's looking at the Playboy. She lands on his bed. He's like, thank you, God. On the float for the Deltas, and on the side of it, like in tissue paper, it says, eat me. And then you've got Kevin Bacon, who's standing there. He's trying to keep everybody calm, and he's like, all is good. All is good.
Yeah.
And this is the only part of the whole movie where I think the realism goes right out the window. They trample over him, and then he looks like a cartoon. He's like flattened on the sidewalk.
The dead horse wasn't cartoony for you.
The dead horse was, frame. Yeah. Actually, I want to talk about that scene as well. So, you know, they're at the University of Oregon. The dean of the college has allowed them access to his office. And so they drag that horse. That's his actual office. The guy that agreed to let them shoot and all that stuff. So they're like, well, I guess it's okay. So they drag that horse in there, and that's his real office.
Wow.
And then, of course, they're terrorizing Flounder, trying to get him. They want him to think he's killing the horse, but they gave him blanks. He fired it up in the air, and of course, the horse has a heart attack and dies.
That's
funny.
That's good comedy right there.
That's funny. All right, let's flip over to Revenge of the Nerds and talk about a few funny scenes there.
Yeah.
Okay, Takashi, what do you got?
Well, I think I have a frush.
What the f*** is a frush?
So as I was watching this movie, it's been nearly 40 years since I've seen the movie, you know.
Right.
I saw it early on when it had been released on VHS, when I could sneak it by my parents because right. I wasn't allowed to watch rated R movies. But it's been a long time. And when I was watching it for the first good half hour of the movie, I was just like, whew, this is just not even kind of mildly funny. It's just okay.
Yeah.
But it was a slow build. It was a slow build.
Okay.
But the movie takes off at the party scene when they invite the moose over.
Right.
That is where it takes off. And I think that's due, I mean, number one, the comedy starts because you have the Lambda, 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 UN, Bernie Casey guy there and his little, you know, helper who's laughing things up. And then they pull out the joints.
The Wonder Joints.
Yeah. The Wonder Joints. And then they put on the music. And I couldn't believe this. I'm listening to Thriller.
Yeah.
Like the original Michael Jackson Thriller music for at least 3 minutes.
Sure.
I mean, it's crazy how long they play this as just music that they're all just dancing to. And the dancing is hysterical. And the girls coming onto the guys and the guys coming onto the girls. It's all fantastic. But it just takes off at that moment. And I was just like, wow, how did they manage? I mean, this tiny budget little movie, how did they manage to get the rights to Thriller? Well, crap, that was just the beginning.
Right. They played Burning Down the House by the Talking Heads,
which was huge in 1984.
It was.
And then they played a throwback to the 70s, but still a fantastic song, We Are the Champions by Queen.
It was mind-blowing.
I mean, key moments in the movie, and they get full... I couldn't believe that they had access to all of this incredible music.
The budget of this movie is $6 million.
Yeah.
You can't get Thriller today for $6 million.
Probably not.
Yeah. I don't know how they did. I think maybe it just wasn't a big deal to play... So I don't know. I mean, 1984 playing Michael Jackson, that seems like a pretty big deal.
Heck yeah, it's a big deal. They had to have... I don't know. They had to have had the inside track somehow. I don't know how they did it, but it was... I was impressed.
But yeah, that's when it really takes off. The scene that I always thought was hilarious is when they get the liquid heat and they put it all over the jock straps for the football team, right?
Right.
Right? I think you even said this is a use of a chemical weapon.
Yes.
And they're all standing there. And I, as a kid, I was watching this. I'm thinking, this is the funniest thing I've ever seen. They're standing there and they start to kind of fidget.
Yeah.
And the coach is speaking, talking to them, giving them pep talk. And they start to fidget more and more and more. And then they start throwing their cups on them. And then they take off running.
He's like, let's go get them. And they all take off to the locker room. And he's like, we forgot to practice.
Improved line by yes. John Goodman.
Yeah. That by the fun. Way, I hope I don't get too graphic on this. When I was a little kid, just to talk about the chemical burn thing.
Yeah.
It's unsettling how uncomfortable that can be. But I remember going to a function with my mother, and they had some salsa on the table that included some jalapenos. And I guess I had picked one of the jalapenos up. And then I'm a kid of like 5 or 6 years old.
Right.
And then I went and, you know, went to the bathroom and I came back. And then like, I'm like, it was exactly like the movie where it's like, you're like thinking about it, you know, you're like, what's going on? And you're like, you move to one side and then you move to the other side. And then it's like, well, I can't just reach down there and grab. What am I going to, oh, this is getting worse. And finally, my mother turns to me and she's like, do we need to leave? And I was like, yes, we do. And she's like, oh, okay. And yeah.
Scovilles.
I was like, I don't know what happened. And she was like, you held the jalapeno, bro.
Yeah.
She didn't, of course, say bro, because that was 1993, but whatever.
Okay, let's talk about the carnival of events where they have to try and win the fraternity prize.
The contest.
The contest, sir. Right? So they do some funny things, like they have the beer tricycle race.
Yep.
We talked about how the guy who played Takashi really was drinking actual beers, and so he was actually hammered from doing those tricycle races.
Right.
Which was hilarious.
Not to mention this absurdity was endorsed by the university there.
The coach is up there. He's like, at which point everyone's going to chug a beer. Then they have the bull riding. They have the tug of war. They have arm wrestling. And then they have the belching contest.
Yeah.
And you get a kind of a half-hearted effort from Ogre.
Right.
And then you have the booger belch.
Frankly, I'm not too wild about this next event, but it has become a tradition here at Adams. The belching contest.
Our first. Now, there's a rumor that some say is untrue, but in my estimation, I like to believe the urban legend, if it is one, on where they get this burp sound. Do you know this story?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, I mean, part of it is actually a man burping, but if you listen, it extends out some distance, and apparently what they used was a sound clip from a National Geographic where there was one camel copulating with another camel. And so this is the sound of camel marital bliss, if you will, that makes the sound for this extended burp.
That's funny. That's funny. And then you have the javelin throw.
Wait till you see Lamar's throw.
How come?
Worms is a master at aerodynamics, and he designed the javelin to go along with Lamar's limp-wristed throwing style.
Where we see Stan knows what he's doing, and They've aerodynamically designed the Javelin for Lamar's limp-wristed throw.
His limp-wristed throw.
This is not PC anymore, boys and girls. 40 years makes a lot of difference. Let's just tell you.
That's funny.
By the way, that actor had to go and like play some of the manliest parts after this just to establish that he wasn't...
Overcorrecting, huh?
Yes, that he wasn't limp-wristed, so to speak.
There's another funny scene where Wormser's the little kid, like the brainiac little kid.
Right.
Who's like in college at age 12.
Right.
And I saw an interview where the members of the crew and the director supposedly watched out for him and made sure that this 12-year-old didn't get into any trouble. They didn't want him exposed to any kind of unnecessary sexual stuff or alcohol or drugs or whatever.
Right.
But there is one really funny scene where he's having a conversation between two giant sets of boobs. He's talking to one set of boobs, then he turns and he talks to another set of boobs, and he gives this great cheesy smile. It's really funny.
Breaks the fourth wall and just lets you in on the joke.
Yes.
He does a great job with that. Yes. Yeah, so he was a part of the scene where they go into the sorority house and are planting all the cameras, right?
Right.
Well, it turns out that sorority house that they used was actually a rat-infested, dilapidated, abandoned apartment. All they did was take one hallway, repaint that hallway, and that's what they used for that scene as they're chasing them around, panty raiding, if you will, the sorority house.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's crazy.
Okay, so we talked a little bit about the music in Revenge of the Nerds. Let's jump back. Let's talk about some of the songs that we get in National Lampoon Animal House. I mean, there are some freaking amazing songs in this one.
No doubt. Let's do it.
Okay, so we mentioned last time that the composer for this one was Elmer Bernstein, friend of John Landis's family, composer for the Ten Commandments.
Right.
But they pulled some songs in. Some of the time, it was songs sung by the cast. But one of those moments was a song called Money, That's What I Want, which was made very popular by the Beatles, of course, but was originally, and the Beatles covered that song, and it's John Belushi that's singing it in this one.
Really? Okay.
Yes. But the writer for the original song is a guy that we've talked about in one of our Patreon episodes named Barry Gordy.
Really?
Yep.
How about that?
So if you guys are interested in hearing the Barry Gordy family tree and a special song that had a special appearance by Mr. Michael Jackson on it, you should go check out our Patreon episodes. For as little as $5 a month, you can join our Patreon family and hear all of those One Hit Wonder episodes, patreon.com/surelypodcast.
You ready to talk about Louie Louie?
Sure. Yeah. We can talk about Louie.
So before we were recording today, you and I were looking at some stuff, and I told you that American Songwriter said this is the most influential, most important rock song of all time.
That's a pretty big statement.
That is a big statement.
Big statement.
This song came out in 1963, which you bend the rules a little bit because Animal House was set in 1962.
Correct.
It was originally written in 1955 by an R&B guy named Richard Berry.
Yep.
Okay. Now, the lyrics are basically unintelligible.
Right.
You can't tell what they're saying.
Yeah.
And so the FBI launched an investigation into the lyrics of this song. This is a true story. Because the governor of Indiana, Matthew Welsh, declared that it was pornographic in early 1964 and wanted the Indiana Broadcasters Association to ban it. And the investigation spanned offices in several states with technicians listening to the song at different speeds, trying to discern obscene lyrics.
So this band, the Kingsmen, IMDb literally refers to them as a frat rock group. It's great. But Louie Louie was their debut single. As you said, came out in 1963. The recording, they did it for $36 at Portland's Northwest Recorder Studio. $36.
$36?
Solid investment, Kingsmen. Well done.
Gosh, that is an incredible return.
It went on to hit number 2 on the Billboard pop charts in 1964.
gosh, I don't think there's been a decade gone by that they haven't used it in a movie since its release.
This became a national hit when a disc jockey in Boston played it and declared that it was the worst song that he had ever heard.
I love it.
All right, what else you got for me?
So there are a couple of awesome Sam Cooke tunes on here. We've got Twisting the Night Away.
Definitely.
Love that song. And then we got a song called Wonderful World, which whenever I hear that title, I always think of the Louis Armstrong song.
For sure.
But this one is the one that he starts, don't know much about history.
Yeah.
Don't know much biology. That song's Wonderful World. I would not have guessed that that was the title of that song, but there you go. But Sam Cooke, again, an incredibly good song. But as with other movies, I think that the pinnacle song for this movie has to be the Isley Brothers singing Shout.
You know you make me wanna shout, kick my heels up and shout.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. They played that at every fraternity party known to man ever since 1963.
Yes, it is it's a great mix of early rock and roll. This came out in like 1959. Early rock and roll and R&B and gospel. Like, it was his way. Actually got calls from black churches saying, we please stop playing that song because it sounds like a black gospel church song. We don't want you playing it on the rock and roll stations.
Here's a quick trivia question for you. In the movie Witness with Harrison Ford and Kelly McGillis.
Yes, okay, I'm familiar with that movie.
Harrison Ford's character, John Book, is staying at the Amish place and kind of getting ready to put the moves on Kelly McGillis' character.
Right.
He sings a song and they end up in bed. The song, Sam Cooke's What a Wonderful World.
Nice. Nice.
Yes.
Good job. Good trivia.
There you go. By the way, the Sam Cooke story, tragic.
Yeah.
Okay, so I just want to tell you quickly about the Sam Cooke story. I can't remember what episode. We kind of touched on this.
Yeah.
But on December 11, 1964, he was at a hotel room. He had brought a girl back to the hotel, and then she wandered off, and he went down to the hotel manager's office, banged on the door and said, where's the girl? Where's the girl? And she's like, what girl? What are you talking about? Busted in the door. This is according to the hotel manager, wearing nothing but one shoe and a sports jacket and nothing else. He grabs her and is like, where's the girl? Where's the girl? And she's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And they wrestle and fight. She pulls out a gun. She shoots him and kills him. 1964.
Wow.
Of course, Sam Cooke, one of the great voices.
Absolutely. That's a tragic story.
There you go.
Tragic. Okay. So two small budget, low expectation movies turn into monumental successes. Both of these movies.
Some of the biggest college comedies of all time?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the biggest. I couldn't tell you bigger at this point. No. I mean,
Animal House is the godfather of college comedies.
It very much is. Yes.
Okay, Dee, before you get to the success of Animal House, I want to circle back on a story that I started in part one. So one of the head executives at Universal, a guy's name was Ned Tannen. He was grumpy, didn't believe in the project, didn't really want to do it. He finally agreed because Tom Mount and Sean Daniel at Universal were big fans of the magazine. He's like, fine, $3 million. Let's throw $3 million at him. Maybe we can make a couple of dollars in the college crowd. Okay. So the original cut of Animal House, 135 minutes long.
Oh, hello. That's
right.
That's not comedy length.
Right.
That's 2 hours and 15 minutes long. That's a lot.
Yeah. And so I told you, they went to the editor and they're like, we think this is all great. And the editor says, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to shake the tree and everything that's unnecessary to this movie, we're going to shake off. And then whatever's left is going to be great.
Perfectly pruned tree.
Perfectly pruned tree.
Perfect. Yeah.
And so they're like, great, let's do it. So they cut it down to, what is it, an hour and 45 minutes, hour and 40 minutes, something like that?
I think John Landis said he learned a lot from that experience, that idea of you can't just dump the whole thing, no matter how good they are.
Right.
You can't dump that whole thing on somebody.
Right. So they go to show it to Ned Tannen.
Yeah.
And he's got his arms crossed, not laughing, not enjoying it. And it gets to the part where Otter has been sent to the hotel room to meet up with the bad guys, right? And they jump him and they beat the crap out of him.
Right.
And he's like, this is not funny. And John Landis is like, well, it's not supposed to be funny because this is the part where he gets beat up and it sort of gives them the incentive to get back and, you know. And Ned Tennant says, oh, so we're making comedies that are supposed to not be funny. John Landis is like, man, this is not going well at all.
Right.
And so finally he gets up, he leaves. They're like, fine, do whatever you want with it. You know, make your unfunny comedy. I'm like, man, this guy doesn't get it at all. Like, uh-huh. He does not think it's funny. So they pre-screen it, and it's a bunch of college kids, a bunch of fraternity guys, in fact.
Uh-huh.
And John Landis says it's the greatest reception of any movie he's ever seen in his life. They were going bananas. He said they were laughing so much that they were missing jokes and missing funny scenes that were coming.
Right.
And they were just howling at this movie. Once that happened, he's like, I think we got a hit, fellas.
Yeah.
And it goes from a $3 million budget movie to, what does it make, $141 million?
Worldwide, yeah.
And it's the godfather of college comedies.
It is, yeah. Sometimes movie studio executives don't know what the heck they're talking about.
That's true.
Yeah.
John Landis made one comment that I thought was particularly interesting. He said, when we started out with Animal House, for a while, this movie belonged to Matty Simmons and to Ivan Reitman. And then it became Harold Ramis's, Doug Kenny's, and Chris Miller's. And then for a little while, it became mine. Like, it was my movie.
Right.
But once it was released, it became John Belushi's movie.
Oh, yeah.
And I just thought, that's really cool.
Well said. Yeah, that's very good. Well said.
Yeah.
So, Revenge of the Nerds, as I mentioned earlier, I could not figure out how this movie got made. And it turns out it was because it had a producer that was the heir of a fortune, right?
Right.
And its budget in 1984 was $8 million, and its gross worldwide was $40 million, almost $41
million. Okay.
So $100 million less than Animal House.
Sure.
But we're talking about 1984, arguably the best year in 80s movie history.
Yes. Def Davis, happy to hear you say that.
Yes.
Yes, but you're right. It was a jam-packed year at the movie theater. In talking about Revenge of the Nerds, it was kind of under the radar because the studio thought the big comedy that year was going to be Johnny Dangerously.
I love Johnny Dangerously.
I do too, right? Yeah. Michael Keaton, it's got some stars in it.
Yeah.
But they were paying more attention to Johnny Dangerously, and this one kind of flew under the radar. It's just kind of a dumb, boob, college, funny movie.
Right.
And it ends up being one of the big comedy successes of 1984.
Very memorable, yeah.
Yeah. And Johnny Dangerously?
Not so much.
I liked it.
I liked it too, but people don't talk about it. It doesn't have the stay power as far as iconic movies. It doesn't have the stay power of Revenge of the Nerds.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
Okay, so we know that both of these movies were successes, and both of them made attempts to whore out that success, if you will.
Right.
There were no follow-up movies for National Lampoon Animal House, but many people may not know, there was a follow-up TV series.
Yes, the TV series, which they owned the rights to, so they could have easily called it Animal House, they chose to make the ridiculous decision of changing the title to The Delta House.
The Delta House.
And get this. So I told you this story the other day. So they kind of get members of the cast.
Yeah, they get Flounder. They get D-Day. They get
Dean Wormer. Yeah.
You get Dean Wormer. I mean, they got a lot of the original cast in there.
You know who they didn't get was John Landis.
They did not. And they didn't get John Belushi.
Right.
A guy named Josh Mostel played the Blutarsky part. And a guy named Peter Fox played the Otter part. But as a short-lived show, there is one interesting feature of a new actor or actress in this movie. You were telling me about how crazy it is, how they got this actress.
So they're looking for the pretty girl to fill the Babs role, and they found this girl working at a grocery store. She's
working at the supermarket.
She's working at the supermarket. They hired her to be in this TV show.
Uh-huh.
And she's like, what do I do about my job at the grocery store? And they're like, well, honey, you need to quit because you've got a future in TV and film.
Uh-huh.
That woman's name is Michelle Pfeiffer.
What? Mind blown.
What? Michelle Pfeiffer got her start, her first images on any kind of camera.
Yeah.
The Delta House.
Yep. 1979 through 1979. That's how long this one lasted.
Right?
She was the key hottie in the Delta House. And then within just, what, like a year, she is acting with Al Pacino and freaking Scarface.
Yeah. Scarface, 83.
Yeah.
Catwoman, 92.
Yeah. Delta House, not a big success. No. So what about Revenge of the Nerds?
Are all nerds as good as you?
Yes.
Okay, so here's what I'm going to say about Revenge of the Nerds. Our buddy Jeff Johnson told me he's got the four-pack nerd collection, right? So in 1987, you get Revenge of the Nerds Part 2.
Yep.
Which actually, it has Courtney Thorne Smith. They go to the beach. There's kind of a funny joke about them staying at the Hotel Coral Essex. But that movie had its laughs. It was funny. Now, Gilbert broke his leg, and so he couldn't go with him. So you're down goose, right? You don't have Anthony Edwards.
Anthony Edwards was like, I'm a bigger star than this now.
I just did Top Gun, in case you guys don't know that. But then you have two others. One of them is like Nerds in Love.
Revenge of the Nerds 3, The Next Generation, came out in 1992. And Revenge of the Nerds, Nerds in Love, came out in 1994.
Wow. Yeah.
So riding that for all that they could, I'm pretty sure that that last one was a made-for-TV movie, but 3.8 on IMDb for that.
I have not watched that one. I have no plans to see that one.
Well, they got back Robert Carradine for that, Curtis Armstrong, Julie Montgomery.
What?
Yeah, all back for that. It's just that it was terrible.
Hey, by the way, I got one other story I need to follow up on before we do our final judgment.
Yes.
At the end of Animal House, in the closing credits, there's a, you know, this is a Universal picture. When it talks about who did what at the, you know, at the end of the movie, when it shows Babs, says that she worked as a tour guide at Universal Studios.
Right.
And it says, ask for Babs when you go to Universal Studios. Right?
Okay. Yeah.
So Universal Studios actually had some sort of incentive when you asked for Babs at Universal Studios. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Now here's the deal. I couldn't find anywhere concrete where it said you got $10 off your ticket or you got an extra ride or you got free popcorn or anything. I couldn't find anything.
Signed picture of Babs.
Well, right. Right. But I did see a press release that had been released in 1989.
Uh-huh. 10 years later.
Over 10 years later, they were no longer honoring the Ask for Babs incentive at Universal Studios.
Stupid Universal.
So, I don't know. I think maybe it was kind of the discretion of the manager on duty at that day.
Yeah, and probably it had become, what do they say, viral. Not back then, but that was, it was like everybody knew the secret at this point. It wasn't an inside joke anymore.
If I go to Universal Studios, you can guarantee I'm going to ask for Babs.
Okay. Before we get into final judgment, I got a question for you.
Okay.
You've just gone through Pledge Week.
Yes.
And you've got two offers.
Yes.
One is from the Delta House and the other is from the Tri-Lams.
Yeah.
Which one are you going to pledge with?
I'm pledging Tri-Lam.
Okay. Why?
Because I care about graduating. And that's full of smart people who are going to graduate.
Uh-huh.
The Delta House is full of people who are about to get kicked out of school.
Yeah.
And I want to graduate and get my college degree.
Right. If I had confidence in my own bootstraps success, then I definitely would go with the Delta House
because
that would be the most fun. But if I wanted the most likelihood of financial success, you bet your booty, not only that I'm going to get good grades, but I'm going to meet all the guys who are going to be running the world in the next 20 years.
Oh, guaranteed. Wormser is out there. He's a CEO of some tech company somewhere.
Absolutely. Probably not. He is probably retired, sitting on a beach, earning 20%.
Nice. All right. Well, here we are. It's final judgment time.
Yeah.
I think it's your turn to go first.
Okay. Well, as I mentioned, when I watched The Revenge of the Nerds, I was kind of bored a little bit for the first half hour. Then they came in strong on the party scene. I mean, all of a sudden, I'm laughing out loud multiple times. I'm like, okay, good. The movie has come alive. We've built our character relationship, and now we're really seeing them take off. And they had good, funny scenes after that. The competition was good. And then they finished on a pretty weak note.
It was a downer.
It was not, you know, when you have a Cinderella story, which both of these movies are, she's got to have the prince chase her at the end, right? You got to have Rocky fighting his way to go in the distance. And with this, you just kind of get a whisper end, you know? And I think that they had shot scenes where it was going to be a more aggressive ending, a more powerful ending for the nerds.
Right.
And even we were going to learn that Stan was actually a nerd at heart and had a brother who was a nerd who would come save him from the toughness of the other nerds. These are the deleted scenes that we're getting to.
Wow. Okay.
But instead, we just kind of have this,
awkward ad-libbed speech by Anthony Edwards and a not very cathartic ending. It's just, it's like, hey, we're here now and we're here to stay, the end, and meh. On the other side of that, you got Animal House, which ends in what I would describe as a battle scene. I mean, it was amazing what they did in the carnival.
Yeah.
Carnival. They've got, you know, Kevin Bacon is smashed flat. Things are exploding. People are flying up in the air. Buildings are being knocked over. Dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria.
Right.
And so to me, this was a landslide for National Lampoon Animal House.
Really? Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to disagree with you. So I do believe that Animal House is the godfather of college comedies. There is no denying it is way more impactful. It's given birth to more movies, way more movies than Revenge of the Nerds. But I can't escape my 11-year-old self of wanting to catch this movie on Cinemax because it was just naughty enough for me at the time to want to watch a little bit of, you know, revenge from the nerds. And
a little bit of voyeurism.
A little bit of inappropriateness for me. The comedy of Booger really worked for me at that time.
It is 11-year-old humor at
so
its best.
Yes. 11-year-old me is voting for Revenge of the Nerds.
Well, very good. Very good. All right, guys. Well, tell us what you think. Check us out. We're on Facebook. Obviously, you can reach us at Shirley Podcast on Twitter. You can email us. We've had more and more emails lately. It has been fantastic. Had an email from a new friend in Australia who had just gotten introduced to our podcast, who gave us warm and wonderful reviews from down under. Thank you very much. That's Jason Mack down in Australia.
Yeah, and then we also got an email from a guy named David Kice. I think I pronounced that Kice. And he likes to listen to us when he goes on walks, and he wanted us to do a podcast on Dave Matthews Band. So
yeah, and I mean, hey, I was a huge Dave Matthews Band fan back in the day. But Under the Table and Dreaming, one of my favorite albums of all time.
I would
love to talk about the Dave Matthews Band. And it may, I mean, heck, that may be one of those Are They Worth the Hate albums, because as powerful and popular as they were, they get a lot of bad press these days. It's kind of disturbing because they're amazing musicians. Amazing.
That'd be a fun one to do. Maybe we'll do that one down the road.
Yeah, be fantastic.
D, can you believe what we got on the horizon for the next 5 weeks?
Guys, we are jumping feet first into the incredible albums of 1994.
Yeah, we're going to cover Weezer, the Blue Album. We're covering Green Day's Dookie. We're covering Bush,
16 Stone.
We're covering Collective Soul, the Blue Album. And we're covering Live,
Throwing Copper. Yeah, amazing. All amazing albums that came out in 94. And that's just a smattering. You know, that's just a sample size of the incredible albums that came out that year. So, guys, if you've heard us talk 80s for several episodes now, we are going to jump into the 90s, as we seem to do every fall, and jump into some of the incredible albums of 1994. And that being the case, we have another Shirley song. So since our Shirley You Can't Be Serious band has done 80s versions of our theme song, and we're about to move into the 90s, I said, hey guys, can you do a more post-grunge, Weezer-esque style? And I gave them a whole new set of lyrics that I wrote. And guys, here it is. Say It Ain't Shirley by the Shirley You Can't Be Serious podcast band.
Oh, yes. Can't wait to hear this.
Tension with the Breakfast Club guys, a boombox blasting in your eyes. Is this some kind of movie scene? Wearing my dancing shoes, guess I'm about to cut foot loose, cause I'm living my 80s dream. So let's take a Bueller date, wouldn't you like to get away? Is it really so mysterious? Let's surely take you back in time. Let's surely push rewind. Sure you can't be serious. No Google, no Facebook, no Amazon. Just 1984 jumping Panama. Are we safety flash or dirty dancing? We love a crush groove.
and the romance is true, but it's the stone we're romancing. So let's take a Bueller day, wouldn't you like to get away? Just trekking with Captain James Tiberius. Let's surely take you back in time. Let's surely push rewind. Sure you can't be serious. It's a party with the go-go girls and lost boys, so come on, feel the noise. Let Zoltar grant your nostalgia wish. The girls just wanna have fun, playing with the boys to be the top gun. No, surely you can't be serious. Won't you stand by me, cause I'll be there for you. This winter shade is hazy, so let's go crazy. Buttercup, it's as you wish. It's surely, surely you can't be serious. Surely you can't be serious. Surely you can't be, surely you can't be. Surely you can't be serious. Surely you can't be, surely you can't be serious.
Looks like I missed something.
Yeah, you did. We're all officially kicked out of school. Wormer just got our grades.
They kicked us out of school? Huh. That makes sense.
Hey! What's this lying around shit?
Well, what the hell is supposed to do, you moron?
War's over, man. Wormer dropped the big one.
What? Over? Did you say over? Nothing is over until we decide it is. Was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor? Hell no!
Germans?
Forget it, he's rolling.
It ain't over now. Cause when the going gets tough, the tough get going. Who's with me? Let's go! Come on!
It's time to turn your daydream into your dream job. Wix gives you the power to turn your passion into a moneymaker with a website that fits your unique vision and drives you towards your goals. Let your ideas flow with AI tools that guide you, but give you full control and flexibility. Manage your business from one dashboard and keep it growing with built-in marketing features. Get everything you need to turn your part-time passion into a full-time business. Go to Wix.com.